You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 68. Sometimes people don't want to hear the truth because they don't want their illusions destroyed. Nietzsche.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Before we get started, guys, I set up a special link to help people affected by the coronavirus, and you can donate to Feed America. There is a lot of people in need out there, and Feed America is a great organization. And they're helping millions of people on a daily basis. And they also need your help. If you want to donate even $5, $10, it goes a long way. Head over to indiefilmhustle.com/help. Now, guys, today we have a success story. It's a story of TVOD actually working with Amazon and cracking the code of Amazon and making money with an independent film. The filmmaker's name is Ismael Gomez. And his film is called Death of a Fool. And he was able to use $9,000 of Facebook ads to generate $72,000 in sales through TVOD on Amazon. And in our conversation, I dig deep in his techniques, how he did it, what his ideas were to target his specific niche audience, and much, much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Ismael Gomez. I'd like to welcome yourself, Ismael Gomez III. How are you doing, Ismael?
Good, Alex. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, thanks for reaching out, man. I appreciate it. Anytime there's a filmmaker who wants to talk about distribution and the truth behind self-distribution, numbers, raw data, and all the other little warts and all, good and bad, I'd like to talk to them because it's rare. Like you said in your email, it's a rare thing. There is not a lot of transparency out there. So before we get into that, how did you get into the film business?
Well, you know, I was born in Cuba in Havana, and I grew
Cubano.
Up
Cubano. Sorry, I couldn't help it, man. I have the Cubano. It just comes out, and you know.
So I was born in Havana, and I grew up watching, you know, Disney, Pixar movies. And actually, the first time I went to a theater was to see The Lion King, and I was obsessed with it. Like, when I came out of the theater, I was telling my mom and my dad, like, this is what I want to make. And it started as a cartoon, you know, like animated films. And then my dad, because he was very well connected in the artistic world, he would get me into the film festivals in Havana. And I saw Apocalypse Now when I was like 9. So you can imagine me being 9 years old and watching Apocalypse Now. So, you know, I got really obsessed with that. And I had the opportunity when I came to the United States. So I came to live, immigrated to the United States with my mom. My dad was already here. And I came on a plane in 2009. And I went.
you have to say, for everybody listening, us Cubans, we're known for being good swimmers. So came on a plane. My parents came on planes as well.
Yeah. So I came here and I always had the passion in Cuba, but I finished high school in Cuba. So when I got here, I went straight after 1 year that I got all my papers and everything. I went to the New York Film Academy and I started studying film, and it was a great experience because they're very hands-on, you know? So I've made home videos, but I was there shooting with actual film, like 16 millimeters and 35 millimeters. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty cool experience. It was an amazing experience. And after that, I moved back to Florida. I got my bachelor's in film because my whole family was here already. And, so after I graduated, I went back to New York and I started working as an editor. So I realized while I was in film school, I realized, all right, I don't think people hire directors.
not off the bat, no.
Not very often. So directors end up always working on their stuff. So I have to develop a second skill, you know, and I also realized for me in the editing is where really the magic happened. Like I would be able to save because my shootings were always super chaotic. And when I got to the editing, I kind of like make things work a little bit. So I realized like this is where the magic happens. So I got to learn this skill. So I got very, you know, well versed in Final Cut 7, rest in peace. And
rest in peace.
and then Premiere when it came out, and Avid, and then Final Cut 10. And so I started editing, and I started editing my friends' short films, my own stuff, and then I got my first feature film, and then I got my second one, and I ended up editing like, I don't know, like 9 feature films already, independent feature films. And yeah, so and then after that, I moved back, you know, my girlfriend was here, my family was here, I was up there by myself dealing with the winter, you know, my Caribbean flesh is not used to that.
The Cubans don't like the winter so much.
Couldn't deal with the cold. So I came back here and I had this movie, Death of a Fool, and I had the vision of my company, Robert Hole Pictures. And at that time, Moonlight came out. And I was like, I saw what Barry Jenkins did in Miami and it was very inspiring. And I was like, you know, I can do this. I can be, let's say, a big fish in a small pond, right? I can start here, try to make fantasy films, which I don't see actually when I was doing a lot of research when I made Death of a Fool and thinking about other fantasy films shot in Miami, and I couldn't like find anything. So I got very inspired and I was like, you know what? I'm going to open the company here. I'm going to start making films here. And that's kind of like how it happened.
It's so funny because you've walked very similar path that I have, because I did the exact same thing. I was like, I'm going to be a director, but I see that no one's hiring me right now because I am 20, whatever, young. And I started getting into post, and that's exactly, I discovered the exact same thing. Rest in peace, Final Cut 7. But also everything happens there. And that's sometimes I think a lot of filmmakers don't do that. They don't understand that you need to have a skill that pays you mm-hmm. while you're chasing the dream, while you're building those tools in your toolbox. That's extremely,
for sure.
Well, you jumped on your first feature much faster. It took me 20 years to jump on my first feature. So you've jumped a much, much quicker. So tell me about
this. I had to do a lot of begging.
Oh, I can imagine. So tell me about your film Death of a Fool.
Okay. So Death of a Fool was actually based on a semester film that I did at NYFA, the Film Academy. And so I have been writing it for 2 years. And I was already in Miami, and I started submitting it to screenplay competitions. And then I ended up being a semifinalist in like 3 of them, and then quarterfinalist in 2 of them. And then Blue Cat, it's a screenplay competition in L.A., we ended up winning it in 2018. Joe, the co-writer, and I, so we both won the competition, and they give you $10,000 is the cash prize. So that was kind of like the beginning of the funding process of the film. So after we won Blue Cat, We ended up like talking to some investors that I have worked with in the past for other projects or other businesses that I was running. And yeah, it just took a lot of convincing and I got very prepared in terms of, you know, not counting on Sundance or the lottery ticket, and really trying to think, how would I be able to recoup this money? You know, so we were able to bring a few investors on board. Then I did, I would say, like 30% of the financing myself. And yeah, we got everything together.
What was the budget?
It ended up being like $103,000. So $100,000. Okay. Which was really challenging, because let me tell you, the stuff that we pulled with $100,000.
Yeah, it's a fantasy film.
And, you know, you got like, you have a magic fruit, and you have like magical places, and you have, it's like flashbacks to like the 70s. So it's a lot of crazy stuff. And yeah, but, you know, I had an amazing team. That's what I can say. The cinematographer, the producer, everyone was just so awesome. And that's the cool thing about shooting in Miami, that not a lot of films are being shot here. So everyone was really excited about that. You know, people were willing to just work and give you good rates and all that to make the film happen.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened with me when I made my first film there. I mean, I was so excited just to be like, oh, someone's shooting. Let's do this. You know, it's not Bad Boys, but we'll do it. Let's go.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. Now, you when you made you finished the film. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm assuming you went down the festival circuit and the distribution path. So tell me about what you felt. Did you do the festival circuit at all? Or what did you feel?
Well, I sent the film to Sundance.
Of course, because we all have to donate money to Robert Redford's retirement.
You know. So I was like, you know, let me send it here. Actually, the cinematographer, Layla Kilborn, she had been to Sundance like 7 times. She even won with documentaries. So, you know, I sent the film to Sundance, and I did, I think Sundance was the film festival, because I had just finished it and I didn't want to send like work in progress to film festivals, you know? So I sent it to Sundance, and then, you know, got the rejection letter. And around the time, so I had a really tough call. This is where we get into distribution, because then 2020 had just started, you know, and I had to wait probably till the summer when the film festivals were going to open again. You know, like the fantasy film festivals, also like
Fantasia.
Fantasia, Fantastic Fest, you know, all those. So I was like, should I wait until the summer, like waste 6-8 months and wait for this film festival? Or should I just launch, do a theatrical premiere here in Coral Gables, the art cinema, and launch the film on Amazon? Or should I just wait for the film festival? So I really hate being passive, you know, and putting like hoping that someone else, you know, allows. And by the way, I didn't even, you know, I heard about the coronavirus in China and all this. This was like in January or February. And also I had an eye-opening experience, because I ended up going to Sundance with the co-founder of Rabbit Hole Pictures, one of my best friends, Larry. I told him, you know, we should go to Sundance, even though we didn't get in. I feel that we hear so much about Sundance, and I've never been to Sundance, so we should go check it out, you know? And for me, when I went there, and the eye-opening experience that I had is that even people that I saw got into Sundance were struggling to get a distribution deal.
Oh, absolutely.
And I saw everyone hustling. And I'm like, okay, they made it here, and they're still hustling and trying to get a distribution deal and thinking they might get like ripped off. So this is not even a guarantee, you know? So I think I might be better off just distributing the film myself, learning this process, try to do my best, and really be self-reliant, you know? So I made the call, and I told, you know, I spoke to my to the producer of the film, and I told her, like, I think this is the way to go. And we had the screening here at Coral Gables. It was completely sold out. And then 2 weeks later, because, you know, it was still hot, and, you know, I released the film on Amazon Video. Yeah.
Now, did you get some deals? Did you get some deals offered to you?
Yes. Yes. So I spoke to a few. First of all, I saw all the episodes on Indie Film Hustle about distribution, you know, and I wrote, like, I actually have a notepad, and I wrote every time that I had an insight or something that I didn't know about, I would write it down and then revisit, you know.
You were prepared. You were locked and loaded when these guys came to you. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I'm so happy so about. They came, you know, they came trying to bite. A few of them, I think a few of them had good intentions, I would say. But still, I was like, even though
the deals, so what were the kind of deals you were getting? You don't have to say names, just kind of deals.
Yeah, so with sales agents, you know, I feel them wanted to charge me, which I thought, I don't know, if you really think the film has potential and you can make some money, why would you want to charge me, you know, up front? But I guess, you know, they need to keep their business going and all that. But that for me was you know, a red flag. I didn't want to, even though if it had good intentions, I didn't want to give into that because it was money that I would use, you know, that I could use in Facebook ads or things like that, you know? Mm-hmm. And with distributors, a lot of them didn't reply. And the ones that did, they had like 15-year, you know,
15-year terms.
Contract. Yeah. And I was 15 years. Like, you're going to own my movie for 15 years. That's a long time.
With no money up front, I'm assuming.
With no minimal guarantee. No money.
And was there any marketing capital or?
Oh, of course, it was like $100,000, like $50,000 every year. It was every year, yeah. And I was like, all right, you're gonna spend $50,000 on my film every year, I guess.
Every year they had that sons of.
Yeah, and then you could I was like, is this negotiable? And then they said yes, and then okay, and then they would negotiate and bring it down to 10 years, and you know. $20,000
but isn't that interesting that they, and I've said this a bunch of times, that they throw out the worst deal to see if you bite, and if you bite, oh good, I'm going to screw you now.
Yeah.
And then if you want to negotiate, I'm just going to screw you a bit less. I'm still screwing you. At the end of the day, you're getting screwed.
Yeah. It's kind of like they want to stab you. Right. And they first put like a shotgun. And you're like, oh, a shotgun, that's really bad. And then they show you the knife. And it's like, oh, okay, I guess the knife is not that bad.
Would you rather get your head blown off or just a little stab in the back? It's just a little.
So, okay.
So none of these, obviously none of these deals, after listening to everything I've said, you just said no. If you wouldn't have listened to all these podcasts, you might have been.
Probably, yeah. Probably.
That's why I want that information to get out to as many people as humanly possible, man.
You have to. They're persuasive. They are persuasive.
Sure. What did they promise you? They promised you to get you on all the platforms, right?
Yeah.
Oh, like, I'll get you on all the platforms. Everywhere. I know somebody over at Netflix, so we'll pitch Netflix. I know somebody over at HBO. Maybe I could get you an HBO deal. I got someone at Showtime. Maybe we could do a pay cable deal.
And what's the special placement? We're gonna get you
the special placement,
you know, on the top of the iTunes chart and all those.
Because
things.
If you go with us, like if you go through an aggregator, you're just gonna be thrown in. But if you go with, you get special placement on iTunes, and that whole scenario, it's getting worse. The predatory aspect of distribution is getting worse and worse as everything starts to tighten around. So that's why I wanted to bring you on, because you're pretty fresh. You're like, this is happening within the last 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
You were getting these offers. And all right. So
And even the ones that have good intentions, let's say, they're still a business, you know, and they still need to survive.
It's the old business model. Yeah, it's the
and if they have 10 films and 9 of them are performing better than mine, you know, they're gonna sell those. They're gonna pay more attention to those 9. And it's not only that. It's also like, I always put this analogy that it's a business, right? And if my film is a tangerine, let's say, and people here buy watermelons, they will market my film as a watermelon to people who like watermelons because they have to sell. And I don't want I want people who like tangerines to see my film. I don't care about people who like watermelons, because then that's where the bad reviews come and I feel that I'm actually, you know, cheating. right? And I'm lying to people because I made you think that this was a watermelon and you came, saw my film, paid for it, and now you're feeling happy, you know? And I understand that. So that was also for me, like, I wanted to have full control, you know? I'm a little bit OCD, so.
Yeah, no, and obviously, so you're telling me that distributors might lie in trailers to get to buy the movie? I can't believe that. That seems so unlike Hollywood. and that's the other thing that that filmmakers don't understand is when they do sign a deal with a distributor, unless it's in the contract, they have no control of how that movie is presented. Poster design, trailer design. I remember when I had a short compilation and a distributor picked it up. I was able to get it back from him. But he put on the cover some woman with a gun who had nothing. She wasn't even in the movie. It wasn't even the movie. I was like, what is this? And it is the nature of what they're trying to do. It's the old model of doing things. So it's going to be interesting to see how this is all going to keep going. So obviously you decided that the traditional distribution was not going to be your path, and your budget range makes it a good viable option for self-distribution. So tell me your journeys through self-distribution and what happened.
So, you know, I started looking into how would I self-distribute, like where, you know, what platform I would use. So, you know, there was Vimeo, which obviously has an amazing potential because I think you keep like 90% of the revenues. Mm-hmm. And then there was Amazon, and then there was other things like selling from your website, like Gumroad, I think it's called, mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of those. But for me, just thinking as an audience, like, it's better, like, people trust is a big thing, right? So mm-hmm. people trust Amazon. People don't trust Vimeo or Gumroad. Not a lot of people, like 1% of the people. So
not movie-going people. Like, people buying online products or courses or things like that, they might want to do Gumroad and Vimeo. The filmmaker will understand who they are, but general public won't.
Yeah, so I was like, you know, Amazon is the best deal. And also, you know, even though I could have gone through an aggregator, right? Mm-hmm. I think I looked into FilmHub and BitMax, you know, mm-hmm. I felt like I don't want to sparse like the attention. Like, I want to just have one place where I can send everyone. And here's the film, watch it, which I also think if all the sales go there, it's going to help with the algorithm. And more people, they will promote the film to other people, right? So I was like, you know, and I did a few polls on Facebook groups and stuff like that. Where do you watch your movies? And I would see Amazon was always the top one. So I was like, okay, Amazon has to be. And I thought of myself, I mean, I rent movies on Amazon. And so I chose Amazon, which, you know, Amazon is amazing. It's great that they give the opportunities to filmmakers, you know, and I had spoken to them before. It kind of sucks that they take 50%. You know, I think I wish they would take less like Vimeo, but, you know, it is what it is. You got to deal with.
So for people to understand, they take 50% of your transactional.
Yeah. Like, so transactional video, TVOD, you know, if someone buys your movie for $10, $5 goes to Amazon and $5 goes to you. So they take 50% of them.
Yeah. And you know what? I have the same. I mean, I self-published my books through Amazon and they're actually worse, worse than 50% sometimes. But the problem, the exposure. You are the largest marketplace where everybody has their credit card and everyone trusts everything. So a 50-50 split might sound bad, but the amount of access you're getting for that 50% is the only thing that makes sense for that scenario. Yeah. But now if you would have signed a deal with a distributor, then they would have taken a percentage off the, so at the end of the day, you might even get really 10%.
What I'm really curious about is like how much Amazon, I wonder if Amazon offers that same type of deal to big companies like Disney and Warner Brothers. If they give them 50-50 or if they offer, because I feel like, you know, as a small business, as an entrepreneur that's starting, they should offer better deals for us than Disney. But, you know,
that's not the way the world works. But, and we could have a whole episode just talking about Amazon and how they treat filmmakers. But at the end of the day, they have opened up a marketplace that filmmakers. Yeah. So if you like, let's take Amazon off the table, that they shut down and like no more filmmakers.
Yeah.
That really hurts a lot of businesses.
But it's amazing. I think it's amazing what they're doing.
But I agree with you. It should be like a 70-30 is fair.
70-30. I mean, I think it's amazing. I'm really grateful that I can do this stuff, you know, but if I have Jeff Bezos in front of me, it would be something that I will bring up.
Also a Cuban brother.
Yeah, exactly. So I decided Amazon and then
And TVOD mostly, right? It's all TVOD.
Yeah. I personally, you know, I have seen a bunch of my friends gone through distribution and gone through Amazon too. And for me, something that I learned is to not undervalue your art. And this is something that I learned actually in the theatrical screening. So when I had the premiere at Coral Gables, we sold out the whole screening and I actually brought some merchandise. And I remember, you know, it was like this, my cousin who's an artist made like this, she printed the poster on like this wooden kind of like frame and it was really beautiful. And we only made like 20. And I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to make too many and we're going to sell them for $20 or whatever because, you know, not a lot of people are going to buy it and stuff. And like we got there, we screened the movie and right when people came out, it got sold out in like literally in 1 minute. And people wanted like, we want more. And I was like, oh my God, I should have brought this more. Like I should have made more, you know, and the screening was sold out. Like there were like—
So let's talk numbers on that screening. So you rented out the theater or was it a split?
I four-walled the screening, so I ended up—
Oh, you four-walled. So what did it cost?
It was like, so they do by the hour. So it was like $250 an hour, and I ended up doing 3 hours. So it was like $750. I did like a Q&A afterwards with the cast.
And how much did you—
And the tickets.
Just all the ticket sales.
Yeah, so I ended up using Eventbrite again. Full control, you know, I put the price of the tickets, everything. And between the tickets and the merchandise, I ended up making like $1,300-$1,400. Okay. So you know, it was a good day.
You're in profit. And then how about the merch? How much did the merch take you over the top?
Well, the merch was like, the tickets were like $1,100 and the merch was like $300. So combined, they were like $1,400, you know?
That's a good day.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, I can keep doing theatrical in Florida, South Florida, and maybe, you know, do like 5 or 10 more of these, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I ended up like 2 weeks after, on February 20th, I launched the film on Amazon. So the first thing that I did was, so talking about Amazon, for me, learning from that experience, I was like, you know, I'm going to put my film for sale first. So you can only buy it for like only purchase option.
And No rental, just purchase?
Just straight purchase. Because I knew the people that had just seen the movie were going straight to get on TVOD. They were going to rent it. You know, there was a lot of people. I got all their emails that were waiting. So I went straight to TVOD. I think I put like $14.99 was the first price that I did. And I put no rentals like the first week, like the first 10 days, because I knew it was going to be hot. You know, all those people were going to come and buy the movie. So I did that. I put it for purchase option only. I didn't do any. I got a lot of, newspapers, radio, everywhere, you know, talking about the premiere, Coral Gables, like local news. And then a lot of social media on all of our Facebook and Instagram. And then I ended up just putting the purchase option for those 10 first days. So then only the warm audience, the loyal audience, right? The true fans came those first 10 days and they purchased the movie. I can't remember the exact number of how many people, you know, but while that was happening, I started learning Facebook ads. I already had like ran Facebook ads in the past and Instagram, with some other businesses that I had in the past, and also with Rabbit Hole on Instagram. But I hired someone to pretty much kind of teach me like all the ins and outs, you know, all the tricks and little things. And even though I thought that I knew a lot, like this person really taught me a bunch of stuff that I was like, oh, wow, that's how it works. Okay. So that gave me a lot of insights. And I slowly started using Facebook ads and Instagram ads. And for me, what I think has worked so far, which I told you in the email, like I feel that a lot of people always want to, like, I want my film to be seen as many, you know, that many people as possible see my film, right? And I think that's a big mistake. I mean, if they could see it for free, of course, try as many people as you can. But when you have to pay for the Facebook ads, you have to make sure that the person that watches the film, right, the trailer, the teaser, they're really, you know, they trust the brand. And if they don't know the brand, you know, why would they click to watch the movie? So for me, the name Miami, right, was that trust. So, for example, when I was running ads, I realized the copy that would get the most, let's say, engagement was when I would put like, you know, Miami releases a new mystical adventure, a new fantasy film, because I thought if I put like Rabbit Hole Pictures releases a new, you know, mystical, they're like, who's Rabbit Hole Pictures? But when you put Miami, people somehow in their heads, that's what I'm, you know, guessing. They're guessing like, oh, so Miami, it's kind of like made this film, like the city itself, you know, it's made in Miami. So then I only targeted like 25-mile radios, nice. Radios in Miami, and that started getting, you know, a lot of attraction. And then, you know, a lot of experimenting. I think you have to do a lot of testing, like a lot. Like, you know, I had a teaser under 1 minute. I had a trailer, which was a minute and 40. I had pictures. You know, I have different copywriting. And also, you have to get, this is a trick that I learned also, that you have to have social proof before you sent out. So when I would first create the ad, I'd have like my small group of, you know, friends and family that I would send it to them and be like, okay, like this, comment that you saw it, that you loved it or whatever. So when the advertisement would go out, right, you have social proof. Someone sees it and they're like, oh, there's people commenting, there's people liking it. Let me check it out, right? And so what I started doing also, the strategy was I would do video views. So it's one of the options when you run Facebook ads. At first I started doing traffic, which was kind of like a mistake. Like you, the traffic strategy is pretty much Facebook finds people that would click on the ad and would go to the website where you send them. Mm-hmm. But by doing video views, Facebook pretty much finds people that usually watch videos. Like they watch the most percentage, let's say, of videos. So I started using the video ads and that started getting better results. And people will still click on it and go to the website, right? Mm-hmm. And then I would do video views Monday through Friday. And then right. Saturday and Sunday, I would do a reach strategy, Facebook ad, which I would say, okay, so from Monday through Friday, I do this video views. And then right. Saturday and Sunday, I create an audience that everyone who watched the video from Monday through Friday, 95% of like people who watched 95% of my videos, right? I would make that an audience. Facebook would find all those people, create a custom audience. And then on Saturday and Sunday, I would just target those people again and with a reach strategy and be like, okay, now reach as many people as you can within this parameter that I just put, that they're already a warm audience because they saw the teaser, and find them and show them again, you know, the trailer. So that would bring really good results.
But you're using this based off of a $14.99 price point, not a
$1.99. No. When I started doing Facebook ads, I already had the rental option. So okay. I actually brought it down to $9.99 and $5.99. So I started seeing, you know, what most of the rentals will be on Amazon, and I saw a bunch of like new releases were not $5.99 for rental. Right. So I put it $5.99, and actually, this was really funny because you have to test things out. You have to just don't be afraid of, like, sometimes people want to be too, like, logical. And you think of, like, oh, my film is an indie film. Who would rent it? Who would pay $5.99? And a lot of people don't know. You know, like normal audiences, they don't know. They just see a film. If it's a cool trailer, a cool poster, maybe they don't know the actors, but the genre itself, right? Since it's a fantasy, right, kind of mystical supernatural film, the genre itself will sell the film. And if they connect with Miami, they will sell it. And actually, I did a crazy thing for like a week. I didn't make a profit, but I broke even. But when the whole coronavirus hit, they started doing this whole theatrical premieres for $19.99. Yeah. So I actually, for a week, I removed everything and I put it for $19.99. I was like, you know what? Maybe people will confuse me with like Disney.
And that's like, funny.
Like The Invisible Man that was also coming out during that time. And like, I don't know, like 10 people bought it. And you know, it cost me a lot on Facebook ads. So I kind of like, I ended up breaking even. So I was like, you know, I know that I can find more people, but it will cost me more. So let me just bring it back to a different price, kind of like what I had it before. But it was an interesting experience seeing that there were actually someone be willing to pay $19.99 for the film, just like they would pay for any of those big studio films, you know.
So Ismail, let me ask you, in regards to the Facebook ads and Instagram ads, a lot of times I found that filmmakers who spend a lot of money on those, the ROI doesn't make sense, the return on investment, because they're either not optimizing properly or their offer is just too low of price. Like you're talking about 99 cents and $1.99, $2.99, $3.99. You've got to get volume, you know. So if you spend $5 to get a $1.99 rental, that's not business. So how did you make it work?
I mean, I kept the price of $5.99, you know, okay, the rental, and purchase at $9.99. So I knew that every time there would be a sale, I would make pretty much $3, right? So from $5.99, 50%. So I knew that, okay, I have to make under $3. And so I would make sure, and this is really hard. So what happens with Amazon is really hard to track the sales that come from the Facebook ads, because Amazon doesn't give you the information, right? Amazon keeps all the data for themselves.
Oh, so you can't do a Facebook pixel with it?
With Amazon? No, you can't, because it's on the Amazon page, right?
And they're not going to let you pixel that, right?
They're not going to let you pixel that. So I couldn't do a pixel. But what happens is that, let's say like people, what I'm guessing, like people, a lot of times they try many strategies at the same, like what I would do is like, I'm going to stick with one strategy 1 week to see the results of that week. Right. And then I will see, okay, so this week I spent this much and this much came in and, you know, I wasn't doing anything else. And I have counted the clicks on the Facebook ads. And I saw that, you know, every 25 cents, someone was clicking on the ad. So I started kind of like comparing the numbers, and then after 1 week, I would switch to a different strategy. And that way, you know, I would kind of like know what strategy worked the most. But again, for me, it was all about that. Like, you have to know your audience, you know? And for example, I also thought, even though the film has, let's say the film is about a grandson, a grandfather, right? They're like afterlife investigators. So there is a younger audience and there's an older audience. And for me, I focused mostly on the older audience.
Because they have money.
Number one, you know, younger audiences, I say it, you know, for my sister, they don't like to pay for stuff. They want just free content, you know, because I mean, you know, they grew up on YouTube, and even I sometimes like struggle, like, oh, should I pay? Should I really rent this movie, or should I wait until it comes out on Netflix or any, you know? So that's just the subscription mode has changed, you know, people's mentality when it comes to that, right? So I was like, I have to focus on the older audience because they're the ones that are really going to pay for this, right? And most of the time, maybe they bring their children, you know, their grandchildren or whatever, to watch the movie. Now, the problem with, you also have to think about the downsides. Like, the problem with the older audience is also they don't leave a lot of reviews, right? Older people don't go on Amazon and start reviewing, you know, like, oh, I love the film or whatever. And which actually, you know, the reviews, it's such a tricky game because, you know, mostly like people who only have negative things to say are the ones that go and review. Like, you watch a movie and you loved it. It's like, this was the best movie ever. And you don't go on like IMDb or Rotten Tomatoes and you don't review it. You're like, this was amazing. But then, you know, those pessimistic, negative people, the trolls, they just go there and start like, oh, this was awful, you know, but it is what it is. But then I try to, like, you know, if I saw that someone watched the movie or tagged the trailer or the poster or something, I would message them like, please, if you like the movie, leave us a review on Amazon because it can help, you know. But it was a combination, Alex, of a lot of like work on my side. I did a lot of, like, say, you know, guerrilla marketing myself with, you know, on Instagram. For example, the Coral Gables Art Cinema, I went on Instagram and I saw, you know, that they had 8,000 followers. So I would go to each one of those followers and literally message them like, hey, we're a Miami film company. We just made this film. If you like, you know, this type of genre, go check it out. Literally every day I would message until like Instagram blocked me pretty much. And be like, you exceeded like your limit for today. So, you know, so it was a combination of things, you know, and like being on the Miami Herald on the newspaper also, you know, brought sales. And then just combining all that with Facebook, Instagram, and just doing a lot of work. And also, like I told you, trying a lot of different content. People, sometimes you create a trailer and that's it. Like, they market everything with that trailer. Like, you know, I had trailer, teaser, short clips. Like, I at least, like, I don't know, like 30 different types of like assets, let's say.
Right. You know, now, the thing that's fascinating as well is that you decided to focus on your local regional market, which is something that most filmmakers don't think about because they're like, oh, it's just the local. I need to be big. I need the world to see my movie. I need to be as big as Tarantino and Nolan. I need to be that. Where you focus on the regional, which is extremely powerful. That's a much warmer audience, if I can take your term. It's a much warmer audience. And a lot of people will just support because you're a local boy. And Miami's not a small town either.
No, it's a big city. It's one of the big
in the U.S., absolutely. So, but even with that, you were still able to generate interest and revenue from that. So that's a really great way of doing it.
And that's not, you know, that's also like, you know, this was like, I, at the same time, while I was in post-production, you know, I really studied a lot of like marketing, you know, like Seth Godin. Yeah, you know, the Purple Cow. And there's another guy called Roy Sutherland. He's from London. You know, and really started marketing and try to learn as much as possible. And one of the ideas is like how ideas like spread, right? And everything starts small. Like, if you think about Facebook, how did Facebook start? Facebook started in Harvard, and then it started with only Ivy Leagues, right? Mm-hmm. And then once they got the Ivy Leagues, when people see something that they like, they will tell their friends, and their friends will tell their friends, and that's how things spread. So I was like, I'm only going to focus in Miami. And then from there on, actually, later on, I started seeing there were some sales in the UK where I was doing no marketing, and which was really interesting. I was like, I don't know how people in the UK are watching this, but I guess they're just like, because they see it as an American movie, they're watching it. But, you know, I really focused just on local and make, like, I would target Miami 25 miles radius, right? And I would say people who liked Pixar, Disney, Harry Potter, you know, films that were kind of had the same tone that my film. And then I would also do besides that and would narrow down the audience that they would also purchase on Amazon.com, which is pretty much everyone. But, you know, but that would really put it like, just find those people that have purchased on Amazon, which, you know, that like they have Amazon Instant Video, whatever. And they like these type of films that are similar.
Now, what? So let's get some numbers, if you don't mind. What are the returns of all of this work, and how much revenue have you generated with off of Amazon?
So Amazon has been like $36,000, which
that's insane.
Which is, I mean, it, when you really think about it, it was 72, you know,
but they took, and that, so that's 36 to you.
36 to me. Yeah. 36.
So you generated 72,000 gross mm-hmm. off of this technique, off of what you're doing. and you're $100,000.
Yeah.
Indie with no stars attached in a unique genre being like mm-hmm. fantasy is not, you know, it's, there's less sharks. Or less blood in that water. It's a little bit more blue ocean-y, if you will. Yeah. The fishing's better in your area. So it's a niche. It's a niche. Mm-hmm. It's a large niche, but it's a niche. So you've been able to generate. And then how much did that cost you?
And then $9,000 in marketing, around $9,000 so far. So that's, the profit ends up being like, what, 27 plus the what I made in the theatrical premiere.
I don't know about you, but I will spend $9,000 every day to get $27,000. All day. I'll just continue to feed that beast. So yeah. It's fascinating. You're one of the few heard of you're making it work. Now you have there's a lot of unique elements like in every project. Like you mentioned Range 15 in your email. That mm-hmm. was a unique set of circumstances in a unique time period. Every movie is going to be a little bit different. Like your movie might be hitting at the right time with the right movie.
That also helped, the whole COVID situation that everyone was stuck at home.
And looking for new, fresh content. And then you just happen to be, right I've got there. Fresh content. I also know how to market it because I've done my homework. I've done my research. And I want you to tell all the filmmakers out there, please, because I've been preaching this for the longest time that filmmakers need to understand marketing, they need to educate themselves on the distribution process, the self-distribution process, all the non-sexy, because everything you're talking about is not sexy. It's not as sexy as the new Alexa with the new the cook lens,
yeah.
You know, and the techno crane that I'm going to work on, and it's not the sexy stuff. Can you please tell the audience the value that you have found by doing that deep dive into marketing? Because obviously it's working.
Yeah, I mean, I would tell you this. This is how I think about it. If you know how to market, if you know how to distribute, if you know how to sell anything, then you can make anything, right? It's not like you make something and then like, how am I going to sell this? It's like learn how to sell things. Like I think of like Steve Jobs, which I think is one of the greatest marketers ever, right? How he created Apple and all those things. And he would find how to like think about it, like how people pay six times more for an iPhone, which is pretty much does the same as an Android, you know, an LG. Like
it's just not as pretty.
It's just not as pretty. The brand, because he grew the brand he connected with a certain type of appeal. And for me, it was like I thought about like, you know, I have, because people just like to make things, you know, as an artist, you just want to think about the creative process, but then you end up being, you know, at the mercy of like, you know, distributor. And sometimes you will find a good distributor, but like, even if you have a good distributor, wouldn't you want to know how that works? And they might not even you. I mean, if you know your audience, if you know your movie, your input might be, you know, so valuable for them that might help even with the sales. So for me, it's like you have to learn, you know, again, like I would recommend Seth Godin, all his YouTube videos. He also has a course that I took online. It's called the Marketing Seminar, Roy Sutherland from Great Britain. You know,
Gary Vee.
It's amazing. Yeah. You know, he's actually doing tea with Gary Vee every morning at 9 a.m. I follow him. Yeah, he's pretty cool. He's got a bunch of good stuff, you know, and watching the Film Hustle, all the episodes about distribution, you know, try to learn as much as you can, because that's the only way that you can be self-reliant and not depend again, on the lottery ticket of getting into Sundance. And I also thought about that. I was telling Larry, my friend, the co-founder, I told him, like, you know, like, I think of Disney. Okay, they're huge. They're so successful. But I think of Disney. I think of, like, you know, Warner Brothers. They don't go to no film festivals. They don't care about film festivals. They go straight to the audience. Why should we? And I love film festivals. I have nothing against them, right? But you're playing by the rules. So why should we be, like, waiting? I will keep submitting to film festival, but we shouldn't be waiting for that to be our strategy. We should be just getting straight to the audience, you know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. So
it's an inspiring story, brother. I really appreciate it. You've been able to do the numbers that you've talked about, which is, like, no one's getting rich. You're not rolling around in it, but you're building a business. You're starting.
No, and I'm paying my investors. That's the most important thing now, that I'll be able to pay my investors, you know, that I can talk again for my second feature film that I want, you know. So it also creates that, you know, trust, which is really important. And I'm building my audience as well, people who already saw the movie and liked it and, you know, saw the company in Miami. So
just thinking from listening to your story, I think you could definitely benefit from reading Rise of the Film Entrepreneur. I think your head's going to explode.
I'm getting it for sure.
If I may do a self plug. No, I think there's a lot of, I think you're leaving a lot of money on the table, honestly, with this, but you're doing fantastic. By the way, you're doing better than 99.5% of the filmmakers I talk to. So you're doing extremely well, but I think you could even do, you could take it to the next level. But I'm really excited that you are a good example of how filmmakers can make money on Amazon during COVID. This is all happening during COVID. And what are your plans now? Because, you know, you did this all TVOD, which is something that unless you know how to drive traffic, TVOD is a lost cause. Unless you can drive traffic and target an audience or have an audience to bring along with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to keep, you know, sometimes the sales are down. Sometimes they go up. It's a little bit, you know, but I'll keep investing a little. I think I may expand now to Florida, try to expand to Orlando, Tampa, you know. But yeah, I'm going to keep in. I actually put, you know, I found the right spot. Now I have the movie for $2.99 and $14.99. Because I feel I feel that somehow I'm getting sales without marketing. Sometimes I think Amazon is promoting the movie itself because, sure, you know, I brought money for them. So I guess the algorithm or whatever. But I would tell this also going back to the whole distributing and stuff, like, for me, I would never put my movie for free. That's just like,
so you're not going to put it in SVOD, like Amazon Prime?
And I would suggest to everyone, put 99 cents, you know, like that's an okay price. If you have a movie that, unless you really don't care about recouping your money because it was your own money or something, and you just want to get people to see your film. And in that case, I mean, you know, you can also put it on YouTube, right? If that's your strategy, but if you really have to make money to pay investors to recoup some money, forget about SVOD. Like, you're not going to make a lot of money unless maybe you have it on, I don't know, Tubi or like AVOD at all the places, but just put it.
AVOD at a certain point, yeah, when your sales have gotten down to a point, cause like nobody really makes a whole lot of money on the SVOD Amazon platform anymore. That's pretty much gone. But AVOD as we speak today is I've seen the numbers. I mean, there's tens of thousands of dollars being made by certain films and certain genres. Mm-hmm. So there is potential there, but I absolutely milk this cow for as long as you can. AVOD could wait. It could wait a year. It could wait 2 years before you go to AVOD.
Sorry, I forgot to mention that I put the film also on Film Hub now as SVOD because the rest of like other English speaking countries don't have TVOD. So I couldn't, the Rabbit Hole Pictures, you know, I couldn't put it on the rest of like Latin America, let's say. Also, because I do have some Hispanic stars that are well known in Latin America. So, and I have the movie subtitles. Oh, that was something that actually bothered me too from Amazon, that they didn't let me put Spanish subtitles. They don't have that option, which I thought, like, you're missing out on like a huge audience.
They can't deal with that kind of complexity from the masses. They can deal with that complexity from distributors who handle 200-400 movies. And they allow that situation. It's a completely different business model.
Well, no, like if you go and actually, like Amazon doesn't allow Spanish subtitles on any film. Doesn't matter. Like,
oh yeah, now they stopped it. Yeah, you're right. They did stop the subtitling. Now it has to be.
I think it's. I don't know if it's a legal issue or what, but I told them like Netflix has been doing this for like years, and you, like if you really want to compete, like you're missing on like you know the whole like Hispanic audience in the United States that would rather a lot of my family members, they when I actually put the movie with subtitles because they understand English, but. You know, you will miss a lot of little details, not the same reading it in your first language, you know? So, yeah, that was one thing. But through Film Hub, that now I'm putting it on Latin America.
But have you had anything from them yet? Nothing come in yet?
No, nothing. It's been recent. I haven't done any marketing also out there. So I'm just letting it to see,
see what happens.
Organically to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, keep us updated on the Film Hub thing. I'm really curious to see. I haven't heard a lot of success stories from Film Hub, meaning that filmmakers actually making a lot of money. So I'm curious to see. In theory, he sounds great, and the marketplace sounds great. But I'm curious to see real hard numbers come in. But man, you're an inspiration, brother. Without question, I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
I would say focus on providing value to others, which is something that, me as a director, when I started, a lot of my friends now that work with me had a really hard time working with me because I was sort of a dictator. And it was always like, I would always think of my movie and this needs to be perfect because it's my film and my name is on it and I'm the director. And then that would just bring a lot of suffering, really, because I would be so frustrated and stuff. And when I kind of switched their mentality and started thinking about being, a provider of value to others, to the crew, I wanted to really try to have everyone in the crew to reach their maximum potential in the cast. I want the actors to do the best performance that they can. I want the DP to have the best images. And I'm just the catalyst for these people to really push them hard so they can get there, And also for the audience that's going to watch my movie, it's not like watch my film. It's like, how can I really make your time worth that you can spend an hour and a half watching my movie and you're going to have a lot of fun. So I just kind of like switching that mentality of, providing value to others. And it really, you can tell when you work with someone who's just there for a paycheck, And I don't like working with those type of people. I feel I can see when there's someone there who obviously I want to pay everyone and I think everyone should get paid, but they're there because they care about their craft more than the paycheck, So I would say that.
Now, and what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
On film or in life? I would say don't take it personal. That's it. Don't take film reviews personally. You don't know who that person is. If they like happy endings and you had a sad ending, of course they're gonna hate your movie. Don't take personal the film rejection, the film festival rejections. Maybe they didn't even watch your film. Maybe that person had a bad day. God knows, right? Don't take it personal. It doesn't say anything about the quality of your craft and or of your film. So that's it,
And then what are three of your favorite films of all time?
That's such a tough question for a filmmaker.
Just three that come to your head right now.
Well, I mean, definitely The Lion King, as a child and in Cuba, I would say I think of films in like different stages of my life. So I would say definitely as a child, The Lion King and The Gold Rush from Chaplin.
Yeah.
The Gold Rush. Maybe. Yeah, it's a fun movie. I always loved watching the movie. Now, as a grown-up, I think, I've seen brilliant films, a lot of brilliant films, but I feel that films that, let's say, that I really saw and were like really changed my perspective on what a movie could be, that I was like, I've never seen anything like this. I would say The Tree of Life from Terrence Malick, mm-hmm. and Synecdoche, New York from Charlie Kaufman, mm-hmm. which is really funny because I see Kaufman, which I think, he's the most original writer and creator like in Hollywood when it comes to film. I think his stories are the most original. And I see him struggling to make films, to get financing. And I'm like, I mean, if Kaufman is like going through this, I'm okay, you know?
Yeah.
It's fine.
Exactly. Now, where can people find you, your movie and your work?
Well, the movie's on Amazon, you know, on Amazon Video. And they can find us on, you know, Rabbit Hole Pictures on Instagram, rabbitholepictures.com, Rabbit Hole Pictures on Facebook, everywhere, Rabbit Hole Pictures. Yeah.
Ismael, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. You're an inspiration. I'm glad to highlight a success story, you know, on Amazon and today's world and TVOD and everything else. So thank you so much for coming on and being so raw and honest with your numbers and your experience, man. Thank you, brother.
Thank you, Alex. I hope this really helps a lot of filmmakers out there and, you know, keep hustling.
You could hear at the end that we finished that interview with a thunderous applause by nature in the background. That lightning strike happened in those wonderful Miami thunderstorms that I remember oh so well. I want to thank Ismael for coming on the show and dropping those knowledge bombs on the tribe and inspiring filmmakers that you can make money on Amazon and you can make money on TVOD, but it takes work and you really need to understand what you're doing. And Ismael is an amazing example of that. If you want to get links to anything we talked about in this episode, including watching his film, Death of a Fool, head over to the show notes at filmtrepreneur.com/068. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, be that filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Filmtrepreneur podcast at filmtrepreneur.com.